KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Elmwood, Berkeley.
I live in the Haight.
North-ish, Oakland.
I live in the Weston Addition.
Lake Merritt.
The Twin Peaks.
Coming up, we'll hear how California's commitment to the cap-and-trade pollution policy will affect local communities.
Environmental justice groups say if you live in a neighborhood next to a big polluter, cap-and-trade doesn't help you at all.
Then the story of a great summer romance between the National Park Service and the San Francisco Public Library.
It's kind of like that. We fell in love with each other and we're like, no, we don't want it to end. Let's keep it going.
And we'll remember the lives impacted by two atomic bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki generations ago.
Most people who have burns, want water, but if you give them water, they die.
Bearing witness. That's today on Cross Currents. California passed a landmark climate change bill a few weeks ago. So why are local environmental groups protesting the bill today?
They spoke to us about environmental justice, but somehow when this huge giant salami got made, we were not included. Our communities were left out.
Activists from Communities for a Better Environment and Asian Pacific Environmental Network staged a die-in outside of the state legislative office this morning. The community members say that California's recent cap-and-trade bill to combat climate change does nothing to address the impacts on local communities. Here to talk with us more about this issue is KALW's health reporter, Marissa Ortega-Welch. Marissa, you've been following this issue for a while now.
Yeah, and what's interesting to me is that cap and trade is really great in this big picture way of addressing climate change. But environmental justice groups say if you live in a neighborhood next to a big polluter, cap and trade doesn't help you at all. This has been environmental groups' sticking point for a long time. You know, they really don't think it addresses the local health impacts of pollution.
So cap and trade, essentially, it allows industries to exceed pollution limits in one place so long as they decrease it someplace else. And Governor Brown just signed an extension in July.
Right, exactly. One bill to extend cap and trade until 2030 and another bill to improve monitoring of local polluters.
Okay, so how will those actions affect us here in the Bay Area?
Well, that's what local agencies are trying to figure out. And so I've actually been following the Regional Air District, the Bay Area Air Quality Management District. That's the agency that regulates air quality for the 9-county Bay Area. You know, they regulate pollution from cars, from industries, to refineries, to concrete plants.
And Spare the Air Days, we get a lot of press releases about those.
Exactly, yes, they issue the Spare the Air Days. They're very good communicators. So last week I recorded at a meeting of the Air District.
Just this last week, the governor signed two important bills that frankly changes the entire landscape for us.
That's Jack Broadbent, the CEO of the Bay Area Air Quality Management District. He and his agency are wondering, how are they going to address all these policies? You know, they're kind of scrambling to figure out what these bills mean for them. In a lot of ways, the Bay Area is already ahead. We're leading the state in terms of our air quality and our air policies. But they still have to figure out, you know, make sure all their ducks are in a row, make sure they're complying with all these new laws, and they have to figure out how they're going to fund all of these new policies.
So, Marissa, you did a story for us earlier this year about the Air District's attempts to regulate refineries.
Yeah, so for years now, the Regional Air District has been considering putting a cap on greenhouse gas emissions from refineries. And environmental justice groups have been pushing for this local cap because they say cap and trade doesn't go far enough. They say if we want to address local health impacts, we have to limit emissions facility by facility.
That makes sense for a local board to set local rules.
Yeah, and there's definitely an argument for that. But, you know, the counter argument with cap and trade is this is a state issue. Let's let the state handle it. And also these big multinational corporations, companies like Chevron's, they say they don't want to have, you know, one region have certain policies in one place and another region has a different set of policies in place. So the Air District has been considering this cap. They delayed the vote on it until the fall. But now these new cap and trade bills passed. One of the things these bills do is they say that local air districts cannot enforce any policy that reduces emissions from oil refineries. It's very specific. So this exact policy that the Bay Area Air District has been considering, putting a cap on greenhouse gas emissions from local refineries, these new cap and trade bills, it could completely kill that. And environmental groups, the Bay Area Air District, they've been working on this cap for 5 years. And all of a sudden, with these new cap and trade bills, that policy could be dead in the water. This is, of course, really upsetting to environmental justice groups, and they showed up at that meeting last week to petition the board to pass the caps anyway. This is Ratha Lai, a community organizer with the Asian Pacific Environmental Network.
Our community lives next to the refinery. When something happens to the refinery, when there's a flare or a fire, or even in like what happened in a few months ago in Benicia, we're the community that has to go inside, shelter in place, tape up our windows, and have to question the air that we breathe.
So these environmental justice groups are pushing the regional air district to say, look, you can interpret this law to still allow you to put in these caps. You know, these bills, they're sort of written vaguely. They can be seen as open to interpretation. So the environmental justice groups want the air district to come out and say, this is how we're going to interpret this bill. We think that it still allows us to enforce these caps. Other people say you can't interpret it that way. CEO Jack Broadbent, Bay Area Air District, he, of course, is proceeding really carefully. And as he told me, you know, everyone can interpret this differently. You can get a bunch of attorneys all in the same room and they can all come up with different interpretations.
Okay, so this has yet to be sorted out completely, but what do you see happening next?
Well, the Air District has to do their homework. Jack Broadbent said he is working on that. He's trying to figure out how do they interpret this law. What do these mean for local policies? Meanwhile, the Air District is still considering regulating toxic air contaminants. These are other, you know, air pollutants that come from things like refineries and other big industries like concrete plants. The Air District is considering putting in the strictest regulations in the country. Community groups say, though, that's going to take years to implement, right? So they're moving forward in their own ways. One thing that's really interesting right now is a community group has developed an app. It's called Air Watch Bay Area, and it allows people to see in real time emissions coming from refineries. It also allows community members to add their own data. If they smell something near a refinery where they live that they want to report, if they're having a really bad headache that they think might be caused by something that an industry is emitting, if they see flaring, right, those big flames coming out of smokestacks, they can take a picture. They can add that information into this database. Community groups really say, you know, there are these long-term studies that are looking at the health impacts of industries like refineries, and they take too long. And meanwhile, community groups say, people are getting sick, people are dying. We can't wait for these long-term studies, and we can't necessarily wait for the Air District and the state to figure out, you know, who gets to do what policies need to be in place. We need to start regulating these big industries right now.
That's KALW health reporter Marissa Ortega-Welch. Have a health story that you want Marissa to look into? Email her at health@kalw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Ben Trefney, in for Hana Baba. Now we've got a story about an unlikely pairing, not of people, but of institutions. The National Park Service and the San Francisco Public Library are mixing it up this summer, bringing books to the bluffs and trees to the branches. How does that work? We sent KALW's Carrie Spivak to find out.
In early June, I was walking a trail in Land's End, in the Golden Gate National Recreation Area, when I came upon a children's book.
The Fox Wish by Kimiko Amon.
Each page was a mounted panel installed just a few feet away from the next, like story time breadcrumbs.
I have to go, I told him.
It was a delightful story about a fox who steals a little girl's jump rope. But what's a book doing in the national park? Well, did you ever hear opposites attract? To find out more, I talked to Michelle G from the Golden Gate National Rec Area. She tells me that last year, when the National Park Service celebrated its centennial, they decided to really focus on a problem they'd been working on for years.
We have a certain population that loves their national parks, visits regularly, but that doesn't reflect the diversity of our nation or the diversity of the Bay Area. Lower income or people of color aren't necessarily being drawn to the national parks and don't have the access. They both don't know about it, don't know it exists, but also don't necessarily feel that they're welcome to come.
So the parks looked for a partner to help, someone who shared their mission for inclusivity, education, and adventure. If they had a dating profile, it might be outdoorsy conservationist seeks warm extrovert with shared values. Because successful partnerships are based on having something in common, right?
Park rangers are very much into the history and story. And they love sharing what they know about the world. So that's something that librarians and our library staff love to do as well.
That's Christy Estrovitz of the San Francisco Public Library. She runs Summer Stride, bringing free programs like tinkering workshops and drag queen story hour to your local branch. Last summer, she and Michelle G worked together to bring library patrons to the national parks and a love of nature into the libraries. G said there were all kinds of events.
Trailheads and programming and shuttles and just everything you could think under the sun. So we were trying to bring the libraries to the park as much as the park was going to the libraries.
I love libraries and I love national parks. But libraries are indoor places for reading books, right? And the parks are outdoor places for exploring nature. But last year, this partnership brought almost 600 new visitors to the national parks on free shuttles from library branches. And it broke library records for Summer Stride participation and for reading. So I hop on one of the free shuttles to the parks, starting at the Visitation Valley Branch Library. It's as far from Land's End Park as you can get inside city limits. This trip would take an hour and a half on Muni, but this shuttle will get us there in 30 minutes.
Oh, a hang glider. You guys are hang gliders.
As the bus is about to pass Fort Funston, the driver points out hang gliders swooping above the tree line.
Do you see it?
Oh,
it's
right.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful sunny day with strong wind.
I know.
We lose sight of the hang gliders as we turn onto the Great Highway.
If you're lucky, you might see some whales or dolphins.
Suddenly, the huge bus windows fill with a view of the iconic California coast. Powerful waves crash on wide open beach. I knew this view was coming as we made the turn, but it's still impressive. 66-year-old Wei Li is sitting next to me and starts to exclaim loudly in Chinese.
Oh, yo, that's sweet, that's sweet.
She's here with her grandchildren and her daughter, Grace, who tells me this is her mother's first time seeing the California coast.
My mom said the ocean is beautiful. She's so excited.
The family has already shared seeing its first hang gliders and its first ocean views, and they haven't gotten off the bus yet. Each Saturday, park rangers take library patrons from different branches to local national parks. Last year, so many people showed up for the trips that they needed extra buses to meet demand. When we arrive at Land's End, we have 3 hours to go off on our own. But most of the 50 library patrons join guided tours about the Sutro Baths or the native Ohlone people. Grace Lee and her mom take photos with the kids in front of the ocean. I offer to take a picture of them all together.
Ready? Everybody look at me. You're welcome.
Grace works as an office assistant during the week. Today, her husband is working at Safeway. She says she tries to take the kids out into nature every Saturday.
But I don't drive. And, you know, sometimes if you go far away, I need to drive.
Without the shuttle coming from the library, they probably wouldn't visit a place like Land's End. Nearby, another mom, Biju, is reading to her three young children from the book I was mystified by weeks ago.
I will let my jump rope at the park. Where are you going? Rookie us.
The book is here to inspire families to go on a reading adventure.
Okay, next one.
Okay.
At the bottom of the pages are prompts to encourage Bijou and her kids to connect with the outdoors, to look around, and to listen to the sounds of the park. As we board the bus, the driver notices how tired everyone looks. A trip like this isn't all about reading. So why does this work for the library? Well, Christy Estrovitz tells me, without meaningful learning opportunities, summer becomes a time of risk for students, especially those from low-income households.
If they're not actively engaged in a high-quality, high-engagement summer camp or summer learning program, they actually can go back like 2 months of academic progress. If that happens again the next summer, that's 4 months behind and so forth. So it really does make a difference on their academic achievement during their school years, but also in life.
Libraries address this so-called summer slide by offering enrichment programs at their branches. But with the Parks Partnership, the San Francisco program literally breaks boundaries.
The National Park Service opened up a new kind of twist on how we think of summer learning. It's not within the walls of the library. It happens all around our community. I think that's something we hadn't really considered.
But it must start at the library, says Michelle G. of the National Parks.
So they feel safe there. They know what to expect. And then you partner that with the Park Service. They're like, oh, well, if the library, if my librarian says it's cool to go there, I'm going to go there. And so they feel much more comfortable getting on that bus and going and trying something new.
Last summer, 18,000 people participated in Summer Stride. That was more than ever in the library's history. And this year, there's been a 40% increase over that. And the program doesn't end until late August. This was supposed to be a one-time partnership between the parks and the library, a summer fling to celebrate the park's centennial last year. But I asked Michelle G., did this fling turn into something more?
The Public Library and the National Park Service fell in love one summer, and it never ended.
I know, it's kind of like that. We fell in love with each other, and we're like, no, we don't want it to end. Let's keep it going.
The library and the parks are both century-old institutions. If they can evolve and keep the love going, they can provide way more services for San Franciscans. I'm Carrie Spivak for Cross Currents.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Ben Trefney, in for Hannah Baba. We're going to end the show on a more somber note. Yesterday marked the 72nd anniversary of when the United States dropped an atomic bomb on the Japanese city of Hiroshima. Wednesday is the anniversary of the bombing of Nagasaki. Altogether, nearly 200,000 people died in the attacks. Reporter Shiho Takizawa, a current student at the UC Berkeley School of Journalism, has this remembrance.
Every year on August 6th, people gather at the Memorial Peace Park in Hiroshima to remember a day in 1945. Together, they pray silently for 1 minute. More than 140,000 civilians died in Hiroshima, and those who survived live with the trauma of the event. Jack Dairiki, a Japanese-American survivor, was 14 years old when it happened. He worked at an aircraft factory that was 3 miles away from Ground Zero.
There we saw the three aircraft coming toward Hiroshima. They started to veer away from us, and that's when the explosion happened at 8:15.
Mei Yamaoka is another survivor who was born in Lodi, California, and visited Japan with her family as a child. She was 16 years old, working at a tobacco factory that day.
And all of a sudden, this flash.
And instinctively, I fell on the ground, covered my eyes with four fingers, and my thumb in the ears, as we were trained to do when the bomb falls. The blast followed. My body was about 100-pound weight, and I was floating in the air at that time. It was such a strong strength of a blast.
Dairiki made his way to a bomb shelter. When he looked out at the city, he saw a huge mushroom cloud. Later, he and a friend went outside to see what was happening. A woman with burned clothes walked by.
She walking like a ghost with an arm extended out and a rag hanging from her arm. And turned out not the rag, but it was her skin that hanging. And she just stared in front of not a sound uttered from her. She just walked away from us. She probably died, you know, an hour or so later.
The city was filled with ashes, dead bodies, and people trying to survive. The radiation made people very thirsty.
Most people who have burns want water. Well, they said, you know, give it to them because they were dying, but if you give them water, they die. But you try to make them happy with the water, I guess.
At home, Yamaoka tends a Buddhist altar for her sister who died that day. She still places a cup filled with water there every day as a way to remember her sister and the way she died. Those who lived through the bombing of Hiroshima suffer from radiation exposure. Dairiki says his aunt's hands are still paralyzed. For her, the long-term effects of radiation poisoning were so painful that she tried to kill herself more than once. And Dairiki thinks the radiation exposure is why he could never have children.
It's a big question mark. Is it because of the atomic bomb? You never know.
16 hours after the atomic bomb was dropped, then-President Harry Truman announced to the world that the Americans had used a nuclear bomb.
A short time ago, an American airplane dropped one bomb on Hiroshima and destroyed its usefulness to the enemy. That bomb has more power than 20,000 tons of TNT.
Years later, U.S. Army General Leslie Groves said President Truman never read the reports about the bomb plan.
Mr. Truman knew nothing about this project until he became president.
Groves oversaw the international military and scientific effort to develop nuclear weapons called the Manhattan Project. He was interviewed by Bulgarian journalist Stefan Grof in 1965.
This report was not long, and he would constantly interrupt his reading to say, well, I don't like to read papers.
Yamaoka and Dairiki later returned to California. They both feel a responsibility to talk about their experiences crossing the Pacific before and after the war. Because they speak both languages, lived in both cultures, and still battle the effects of the bomb on their lives and families.
So we want to keep reminding people of what happened and never to be used again. You know, it's very important to keep history alive.
Dairiki says, if we forget what the bomb did to the people of Hiroshima, someone else could use a nuclear weapon again in the future. For Cross Currents, I'm Shiho Takezawa.
Shiho is a student at the UC Berkeley School of Journalism. Today's Cross Currents team includes Nina Gensler-Debs, Gabe Graben, Gabriel Greschler, Angela Johnston, Zoe Liu, Lisa Morehouse, Ariel Plotnick, Stephen Short, and Judy Silber. The show is engineered by James Rowlands. Line producer is Hannah Kingsley Ma. Jen Chien is our managing editor. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. For Cross Currents, I'm Ben Trefney.